By many measures, the national economy appears to be cooking at the moment, with unemployment as low as it's been in 50 years. But good economic conditions now do not mean that people who got behind in the recession are all caught up. Quite the contrary, says our guest this hour. Joseph Sternberg writes of how one generation in particular lost a lot of ground in the recession and its aftermath in the book The Theft of a Decade, how the baby boomers stole the millennials' economic future. Joseph C. Sternberg sits on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal and writes the political economics column for the journal. He grew up in Vermont, lives in London, in England, and admits to being born in 1982, making him a millennial. So, welcome to a discussion with a baby boomer, Joseph.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great to have a chance to have this kind of conversation about what's actually going on in the economy for us.
Well, I'm so glad you actually start the discussion with avocados. I mean, have those become a real millstone around millennials' necks?
Yes, they have, and that is exactly the way to frame this issue, I think, because when I sat down to write the book, I wanted to know who is right. You would have this phenomenon with the two major generations, the baby boomers and the millennials, often seem to talk past each other on the economy. And I think the way you set this situation up is exactly right. Boomers will say, well, the economy is really healthy now. Millennials are young people. They're very adaptable. They're resilient. Life has never been so good. And the millennials are saying, well, hang on a sec. We have a lot of problems that got stored up over the past 10 years in the Great Recession and its aftermath. Life isn't actually looking so good for us just at the moment. And I was really curious to figure out who is right in that debate. And it turns out it is the millennials.
Well, and as you point out, millennials are not monolithic. No generation would be. But the idea that they're all busy, eating expensive avocado toast and doing lattes every day is also a stereotype. But they do apparently share economic catastrophe. How did it end up so much worse for millennials? Is it simply because of where they were in getting into the economy during the time period of the recession and its aftermath?
Yeah, that's an important part of the story, that we're having this conversation about millennials mostly by accident. I mean, you are absolutely right. You don't want to overstate the importance of generations. There's this tendency to think about them as these monolithic cultural groups that move through the population. I don't think that's true, but I do think in the case of the economy, you can talk about the significance for millennials because, first off, it is a large cohort in the American population, depending on who you ask. You're looking at people who, about 70 to 80 million people in America right now are millennials, about the same number as the baby boomers. And we all happen to get caught by the Great Recession at the most vulnerable time in any person's economic life, which is just as they are graduating into the workforce and really starting to try to find their own path and get themselves on that road to financial security. And what I discovered is that the big thing that unites millennials more than anything cultural that you could say about our brunch habits is the fact that we all had that experience of having to navigate the worst economy America had seen since the Great Depression.
But as you point out, millennials didn't own much real estate or stocks. So where did they get hurt?
Well, I trace all of this back to the job market. It all goes back to the job market in one way or another. So, of course, people remember that in the depth of the Great Recession, the unemployment rate in America shot up well above 10%. The unemployment rate for young people was even higher than that because the unemployment rate for young people is always higher than for the overall population. And you also had a lot of young people just struggle to get into the labor force at all so they could even be counted as unemployed. You had a phenomenon of a lot of young adults, millennials, finding their way into additional education as a form of warehouse because they couldn't find jobs. And the slow job creation that we saw during the Great Recession and its aftermath and the kind of jobs that were affected, this recession was particularly hard, maybe even unusually hard, on small companies compared to big companies, which isn't always the case in economic downturns, but it was here, and that had a big generational impact because young people usually rely on smaller companies to help us get our start in the workforce, to start developing skills, to start gaining some work experience, especially in an office where everyone has to do a little bit of everything. Millennials missed out on that kind of opportunity. That has really, if you look at the numbers, set us back a lot in terms of our potential earnings over that period, and it's a setback that will take us a long time to claw back from. having gotten that delayed start in the labor market, pushed a lot of us into higher education, where, of course, we had to rack up additional student debts to fund the things like the graduate degrees that we were doing because we hadn't been able to find work when we wanted it. It's delaying our start in the housing market. So you observe housing markets across the country, millennials are buying at lower rates in this point in our life cycle than the boomers did when they were our age. The effects on this have been really deep, and I do think that it just goes back to what was happening in terms of our employment prospects when we were graduating into that economy.
It's useful to remember for everybody, too, that if you went through a couple of years when you were getting no raise or even taking a pay cut, it's not like when the recession ends that your employer goes, okay, here's the 15% you missed all those years. It doesn't happen like that. So millennials, we can agree, lost a decade of growth and won't get it back, but boomers stole it? That's the part that's going to get a few people going, huh?
It is sort of a fair point. I mean, I emerged from this book with a little bit more sympathy for baby boomers than I had thought that I would have. And so my message to boomers who are listening is that I do understand that boomers face their own difficult economic times. I mean, we often associate baby boomers with the wonderful era of the 1950s and 60s when there was a car in every garage and a chicken in every pot, and there seemed to be great economic security for a lot of people, although certainly not for everyone in that economy in that era. But the reality is that by the time the boomers themselves were entering the labor market, they were doing it in the 70s with the stagflation and the gas lines of the 1970s, a very deep recession that hit right in the beginning of the 1980s. Boomers also lived through things like the downsizing revolution that corporate America went through, new pressures from globalization. My complaint about the boomers is that I think that they learned a lot of the wrong lessons from that experience in terms of the way to create economic policies that would help people adapt for that. And it was really the consequence of that mistake and the sort of decisions that boomers made politically that have created so much of this problem for millennials.
All right, let's get into what those wrong lessons are when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Joseph C. Sternberg about his book, The Theft of a Decade. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Joseph C. Sternberg, sits on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal and writes the political economics column for the Wall Street Journal. He's written a book about millennials and how they fared poorly, generally, in the recession and its aftermath. It's called The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. So it's a crime with a victim and a perpetrator in his mind. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the concepts here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's come back to that point about how the baby boomers might have learned the wrong lessons about how the economy works. What were some of those lessons then, Joseph?
Well, I pinpoint the key mistake at thinking of a lot of the trappings of the economic security boomers had grown up with in the 50s and 60s as inputs into the economy instead of outputs from the economy. So I'm really interested in issues like investment in the economy, productivity growth, the sort of thing that really makes it possible for employers to pay higher wages over time, that creates rising prosperity. And the 50s and 60s were a great era for that, and that actually fueled a lot of the things that the boomers started thinking that they should be able to have from the economy. So, for example, having a more productive economy gave workers more power through their unions to bargain for higher wages in that era. I think that the problem that the boomers started getting into when that model broke down, when investment and productivity growth in America started declining, was they thought that if they could recreate those outward trappings of economic security, that would in turn lead to the security itself. And so you saw a change in the way people started thinking about regulation in the economy, and you also saw a tendency basically among boomers to try to use the government to recreate some of that security while also melding it with the productive power of the market economy. And you know, the result of that was often a lot of the sort of third-way policymaking, whether it was the New Democrats of the Clinton era, compassionate conservatism in the George W. Bush era, that were really trying to travel in that middle road to recapture a lot of that security for them. Now, I mean, my argument is that that model really turned out to be very unstable. You ended up with a lot of the problematic parts of both of the, you know, the government and the market forces that you were trying to combine. And then when they doubled down on that kind of policy approach after the Great Recession, created a big problem for the millennials who were the new young people who were having to find their own way.
So this raises the question about whether the boomers, in taking, as you say, the wrong lessons from the economy they saw growing up, is whether they assumed that it was always supposed to be like that. We had Mark Levinson here 2 years ago talking about his book, An Extraordinary Time, arguing that the post-war boom was the anomaly. The question is, were boomers maybe trying to too hard to recreate what they knew as kids?
I think there is definitely something to that argument. I think that one of the problems that baby boomers have always had politically was misunderstanding the kind of economy that they had grown up with. And it was a very unusual era. It was a period when America didn't face very stiff global competition in a lot of markets because our major competitors were still rebuilding from the Second World War. It was a period when you just had enormous sustained investment and productivity growth in the economy. The fertility boom that created the baby boom was unusual. It was a break from the trends that had been happening before that era. And yet, to a surprising degree, even today, you hear a lot of baby boomer politicians, and people who have been inspired by those political leaders, having debates about how do we try to recapture the 50s and 60s in various ways. And I think that is one of the arguments lurking between the lines of my book, is that that kind of thinking is a potential trap for millennials as we start getting elected to Congress and having to make decisions, because you know, we shouldn't be distracted by the same things that distracted our own parents when they were making decisions.
Well, the key point, it seems, is this one that we don't have the same kind of world to live in, or the millennials don't, that the baby boomers had. Because, again, as you pointed out, you know, this is a much more global economy where you're going to get competition from foreign automakers and things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, this is why it is actually so important to understand the kind of mistakes that the baby boomers made, because I think that one way that you can state the case that I'm making about how this actually was a policy theft of a decade from millennials is that the problem is that while the boomers were busy trying to chase after an economy that they remembered from their youth, they made a lot of mistakes that have actually made it harder, I think, for the U.S. economy to adjust to the future that millennials are going to face. So, for example, you end up with a lot of regulations and other attempts by the government to steer investment into various parts of the economy, whether it was high tech in the late 90s, whether it was housing in the 2000s, whether it has been green energy at some time since the 2007 to 2009 Great Recession. Those are all industries that are worth investing in, that are potential paths forward. But you have to ask yourself, how many other potential paths did we close ourselves off from where America could have also been competitive and could have been creating jobs for young people? And so that's basically the kind of mistake I think that we need to avoid. And the way we need to think about these problems is not necessarily trying to steer the economy in one direction or another, but understanding that in order to adapt to the future, millennials are going to have to be able to have an economy that is very resilient, that's very flexible, that creates opportunities for a lot of entrepreneurs in a lot of different industries across the economy to try to feel out what is the way to cross that river. How are we going to get into the future?
Does that flexibility, that nimbleness, come from small scales, both in entities doing business in the marketplace and in the entities regulating them?
Yes, I think there is definitely an advantage to smallness, or to at least not favoring bigness. And in fact, this is one of the big mistakes that I think that the boomers have made all along, sometimes deliberately, sometimes by accident, is that so often the economy now seems to favor big. And this is something that I thought was particularly striking when I was looking at the labor market. If you look at a lot of the policies that we thought about in terms of responding to the financial crisis, whether it was the banking regulations that came in to try to clean up Wall Street, whether it was Federal Reserve policies like the ultra-low interest rates and the quantitative easing that we all heard about, time and again, actually the biggest beneficiaries of those policies tended to be big companies instead of small companies. And you know, that has implications in terms of the nimbleness of the economy and the innovation, because so much innovation actually starts in someone's garage with a small company instead of starting in a big research lab at an enormous company. But it also has a lot of implications for people in the labor market, because, for example, young workers are disproportionately employed by small companies. And so you need to have a very healthy mix, and you need to make sure that Washington or state capitals aren't deliberately or accidentally favoring big over small. I think that actually that preference for big was often a mistake that the baby boomers let themselves slip into.
We're talking to Joseph Sternberg from the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal about his book, The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. Your comments and questions and thoughts about how the economy has proceeded and whose hands and why. Welcome on the Jefferson Exchange. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I have a couple of emails here I'd like to read for you, Joseph. First from Larry in Ashland, who says, as a boomer, I ended up helping out my millennial children quite a bit. Because of underemployment, et cetera, the younger generation has received quite a helping hand from their parents right into their 30s. So that's certainly household circumstances. And then Susan, no town given, writes, this discussion would be more useful if it compared the World War II generation, the boomers, millennials, and the generation after the millennials. As a boomer, I felt that the World War II generation had a huge advantage over mine, as those young people stepped into an unprecedented economic expansion where anyone who was white and male could find an excellent job, and opportunities opened up for others in a growth phase not equaled since.
I think that those are both excellent points. I mean, Larry does raise a phenomenon that does come up a lot here, which is that it is certainly true that the boomer parents who have been able to have helped their millennial children as much as they've been able to, particularly through this down job market. I mean, that is really the whole point of the stereotype about millennials living in their parents' basement, is that the parents have the basement where they can let the millennial live. But, I think it is important that we not extrapolate too much from that to suggest that actually, there was kind of a fair generational balance lurking under the surface here after all. Because first off, you need an economy that is going to create opportunities for everyone. And, one implication of this suggestion that the boomers did help their millennial kids is that the boomer parents had to be in a position to do that. One of the things that worries me is that the economy seems to be working less and less well for young people, particularly from some more disadvantaged backgrounds, who haven't been getting a clear path to success now that we do have an economy that has become distorted the way that it has. So that means that if you have parents who own a house that's big enough that you can continue to crash in it into your 30s, that's great. But if you don't, I mean, your options are often, you have to go into significant amounts of debt in order to try to get higher education, or you have to make your way in a labor market that hasn't really been functioning properly until very recently. So I think that you really have to be careful to think about all of those millennials who didn't have the benefit of that kind of parental support. As to the other person who's emailed in, Susan's point about other generations that have a role to play here, I have a lot of sympathy for the fact that the World War II generation who came home and were the baby boomers' parents did enjoy a lot of advantages. I think that that is certainly something that the boomers can reflect on, but it doesn't change the fact that we've also had a long period when the boomer generation did move into a position where they could make a lot of these policy decisions, and those decisions haven't always been the right ones. And so I think that the reason I focused on the boomers and the millennials is that I just think that that is the most urgent question right now, because those are the two generations that are either making the decisions or being most heavily affected by them.
A brief footnote here, if you would, Joseph, on your footnotes. Every page seems to have one explaining which group of millennials by years. Is there some disagreement about what even constitutes a millennial?
Well, yeah, this was the first thing you discover if you're writing a book about millennials, is that hardly anyone knows what a millennial is. So it's another big contrast with the baby boomer. Actually, there is a very well-established definition. You know, if you were born between 1946 and 1964, you're a boomer. With millennials, it really depends on where the researcher wants to draw the line. I think that the most common definition is people who were born between around 1981 in 1996. You know, people who are in college now are actually members of Generation Z. It's another cohort that comes after the millennials. And you know, this is an important point in its own right that I talk about a little bit in the book. Millennials are older than people tend to think we are. The youngest millennials, if they went to a four-year college degree, are probably graduating from it right about now. And that has a lot of implications for those of us who were born in the 80s and are about to be pushing 40 in the next couple years, because it means that, you know, to the extent that we really did suffer economically over the past decade, we have a lot less time to make up those losses than people tend to realize we do.
I want to come back to this point about jobs, though, because there's a great quote in your book about where you say jobs in the middle range of the labor market got creamed during the recession. What kinds of jobs, and have they returned yet?
Well, one of the things that I personally found most fascinating as I was researching this book was I had the realization that I had been thinking about the job market the wrong way. And I actually think that we do need to change the way that we talk about this, because the traditional divide that we thought about is high-skilled jobs versus low-skilled jobs. And we all assume that low-skilled jobs are the most vulnerable to things like technological change or automation. But that isn't actually, strictly speaking, true. The real division is between jobs that require some sort of cognitive effort in order to perform the job. So it can either be a very high-skilled job like neurosurgery certainly requires cognitive effort, but you can also have a lot of service professions, you know, that we would traditionally think of being at the somewhat lower end of the career ladder that still need a lot of cognitive activity in there. The jobs that are actually most vulnerable are that fat middle, where it might be either white-collar jobs or blue-collar jobs, but there's a real element of rote about it. So it can be things like data entry jobs or working along a factory assembly line where you perform the same function time after time. And those are the jobs that have been most seriously affected by the economic downturns going all the way back to the 90s. You've had a lot of hollowing out there, but again, that has big implications for young people, because I think often you actually start your career in a job that has a big rote element to it, because that's how you get acclimated into the working world, and it is how you learn how to understand the industry and the economy around you well enough to be productive once you shift into a cognitive role. So it was a big problem for millennials that we actually lost a lot of these job opportunities at the very entry-level rote or routine end of the spectrum that ordinarily would have been our gateway into higher-level employment later.
Let's talk about some of the mechanisms that you see as responsible for some of the changes. You walk us through the 80s and the 90s and differences between taxation on earned income and taxation on capital gains. What do you see happening there that could have been done differently?
Well, I think that the big thing that the baby boomers did understand coming out of the 70s is that they needed to find some way to revive business investment in the economy, because that had been the secret sauce in the 50s and 60s, the fact that you had a lot of American companies that were investing very heavily in technologies that would boost the productivity of their labor force, and you know, that would create the wage growth. So boomers understood that they needed to do that, and that actually fueled a lot of the economic policy debates of the 80s, 90s, and into the early 2000s. So really what we now talk about is the supply-side revolution during the 80s, when you had a lot of economists coming in and starting to talk about changing tax rates in order to you know, create better incentives for business investment. That was really what they were talking about, and you know, this was why that message resonated. Now, one of the arguments I make in the book is that the problem is that the boomers didn't necessarily develop the widest range of tools that they could have in order to encourage that. And so they ended up focusing a lot on things that would help get the financial plumbing of the economy to work correctly, whether it was deregulating banking and Wall Street activity or whether it was changes to the tax law that would encourage capital investment that way. But they never succeeded quite so well in unsticking all of the other bits of the regulatory plumbing in the economy. So it still would be too expensive to invest in some kinds of activity. I think that investing in manufacturing has become progressively more expensive over time. You started adding all of these little bits of regulation, bit by bit, that might start making employing labor more expensive for a company.
Is it just the labor costs that make manufacturing that expensive in America? Is that the crux?
Well, I think that there is a debate that millennials are going to need to have about things like labor costs. There's also going to have to be a debate about whether we always strike the right balance between protecting the environment, which is definitely a big goal for millennials. Whether we have the right balance between environmental protection and also making sure that we are still allowing the kinds of economic activities that will create jobs and economic growth and prosperity for us. I argue in the book that the boomers sometimes went a little too far in one direction, and that had a lot of implications for the shape of the economy that we developed. I think that you can look at a whole range of, issues, and, not just in the 80s, not just in the 90s, not just in the 2000s, not just after the Great Recession, but all of these little pieces put together created an environment that was really damaging for the kind of investment that would have benefited millennials once we started entering the working world.
Joseph Sternberg is the author of The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. We're inviting you to join the conversation by phone and email. We'll come back and talk more with Joseph and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Joseph C. Sternberg, sits on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal and writes the political economics column for the journal. He grew up in Vermont, lives in London, admits to being born in 1982. He's a millennial. He's written a book about millennials and baby boomers and money and a source of a sore spot between them. His book is called The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. Agree? Disagree? Have some thoughts on this? Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I haven't talked yet about general expectations and attitudes toward the economy and how those might differ, not just between generations, but between people who are high up in the economy and much lower in the economy. You do separate yourself from people who decry financialization, like Rana Faruhar, who did join us for Makers and Takers. We did a rerun not long ago. But how much of an effect was that in trying to move money up to the top, and or was it a conscious effort, do you think?
Well, the way I think about that kind of issue is that having financial plumbing that works properly in the economy is incredibly important. This is some perspective I've gained during the years that I've been lucky enough to work overseas and get some international perspective on these issues. I can tell you that most countries around the world wish that they had an economy where the financial system worked as well as America's does, that was as effective at getting things like venture capital into entrepreneurial new companies that needed, at least in some industries like the tech industry, where it was easier for small businesses to go out and get loans that they need to finance some investment and expansion. So I don't actually have a problem with the financial system or Wall Street. I think that some of the blame on that part of the economy for the crisis was a little misplaced. I think that the real danger is actually in the interaction between that financial system and the government. And it can happen either directly, if you have a situation like we did in the run-up to the financial crisis itself, where there were all sorts of regulatory thumbs on the scale that were encouraging manic investment in the housing market and mortgage-backed securities. But it can also happen in a lot of indirect little ways that you focus more on the financial plumbing than you do on where that money will go once it has filtered through all of these financial pipes that you have so elegantly put together. And so, I think that should be a guide for millennials who are thinking about these problems. I'm a little worried sometimes that we become too focused on Wall Street or the financial part of the economy, that we lose sight of the fact that it has to be thinking about finance plus thinking about these other things, that you can't solve these problems only by looking at what happened on Wall Street or what happened in a relatively narrow corner of the economy before or after the crisis. So, and that's the big plea I'm making to millennials, my fellow millennials, in the book itself, is to try to have as broad an understanding as possible of how all of these different pieces fit together, instead of following more of the boomer attitude of trying to focus on narrow little pieces that people thought might get it to work properly.
But how, for example, would the government encourage more short-term thinking in investors? I mean, it's not a rare CEO who says, you know, there are things we would be doing. Or let's take an example of Warren Buffett, who talks about his purchase of the BNSF Railway and the fact that he could do things with the BNSF now as the owner through Berkshire Hathaway, more or less taking it private, than he would have done if he'd been responsible to Wall Street, because the expectations of investors to make sure that every quarterly profit is good don't allow for a lot of long-term thinking. How would the government change that?
Well, I think that, there are a lot of dimensions to policy that actually influence that kind of thinking. So one area that I spend a lot of time thinking about, particularly in my day job at the Wall Street Journal, is monetary policy, the things that the Federal Reserve has been getting up to. And you can actually make a pretty convincing argument, I think, that a lot of the phenomena that people point to as problems, such as this enormous trend that we see toward companies using money to buy back their shares instead of investing in growing their business, that ultimately is an artifact of the fact that right now companies can borrow at such extraordinarily low interest rates so that they can then reconfigure their balance sheets by taking on all of this debt that enjoys various tax favors and then buy out some of their equity owners. And you do that to get a pop to your share price instead of actually investing in growing the business. And it is actually a matter of businesses and investors reacting rationally to the kind of incentives that the Federal Reserve creates in the economy. And it gets even worse if you think about, well, what are the other things that the business could be investing in? Where would they build a new plant? Where would they expand a plant? Where would they hire new workers to engage in whatever their business line is? What would be the costs associated with that? You can actually understand why a focus on short-term hits to the, boosts to the share price actually start kind of taking over the way people think about these issues, because that's the thing that's easy to do, and it's often easy to do because people in Washington have made it that way.
So if the Fed had kept the rates higher, you're saying there wouldn't be as much of that activity?
I mean, there is a very interesting debate that I think millennials are going to have to figure out how to have about some of these policy issues, in particular whether the boomer politicians and policymakers who were in charge during and after the Great Recession drew the right line in terms of where the firefighting in the depth of the financial crisis should stop and where the focus should become getting the economy more onto a normal track. I mean, I think that one of the things that's really damaging about this, and it often seems to be overlooked, is the fact that in a lot of ways the firefighting part of the crisis never seems to have stopped. And yet, it became clear that it wasn't quite working the way that they had hoped it would. And I think that a big boomer error in general was this failure to recognize quickly enough if the things that they were trying hadn't worked, and then try to change course. And again, I'm hoping that millennials can learn from some of that experience, maybe be a little more entrepreneurial in terms of our own approach to politics and making policy, so that we can try to learn lessons more quickly as we go along.
Let's get a phone call in here. Here's John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joseph Sternberg, the author of The Theft of a Decade. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question's about the millennials and college. I went to college and da-da-da, and that was our family, but are they facing that same kind of, you have to go to college to do what you do? Because, the other way to look at that is, about 25% of Americans have a four-year degree. There's lots of jobs out there, like police officer, firefighter, have your own trade, own your own business. So where do you think that's going as far as the idea that you really have to go to college to be successful, whatever success means?
All right. Thanks for bringing that question in, John. It's a good one.
Oh, this has been a major disaster for millennials. And again, it's actually an attitude that we did pretty directly inherit from boomers, because remember, the boomers faced a lot of pressure from globalization, from more competition, and the solution was for the boomers to try to invest more themselves in education and skills and training and going to college. And they were definitely passing that on to their children. Millennials were always going to go to college in a higher proportion than the boomers had. That kind of accelerated during the financial crisis because people viewed college as the thing that you could do if you didn't have a job to try to have some hope of finding a job after you graduated. The trap that we have is that actually there's a real question now about whether the payoff is always there. A college degree has come to be seen as a very expensive ticket of admission into the labor market, but you're not always sure which section of the bleachers you bought the ticket to. And in fact, there's never been particularly good or systematic information available about the kind of earnings that a 17 or 18-year-old student could expect from various courses of study. And you know, there's an increasing question about whether it's really whether the four-year college degree is the appropriate path for a lot of people. Now, the thing that makes this a financial emergency, of course, is debt, because, you know, if you're conditioned to think about higher education as an investment in your future, it makes perfect sense to borrow money in the expectation that you'll earn enough to pay it off later. But that hasn't panned out for a lot of millennials who are really feeling like they you got sold a bill of goods in terms of spending $80,000 on a four-year education from a marquee university of some sort, and then finding that the job opportunities aren't there. And I mean, think about it, what it means that you're asking 17 or 18-year-olds to guess at that age at what kind of education, what kind of training, what kind of skills the economy is going to demand from them in 5 years. And then you're asking them to wager $80,000 of borrowed money on that gamble. I mean, it's a crazy system, and I think that one boomer failure is not to recognize how crazy it was and try to explore some alternatives a lot sooner.
Well, and you cite the figure, which is what, $1.4 trillion now in student debt. So that's what has to be repaid just to get everybody back to square one.
Exactly. It's an astronomical amount of money. And this is the one issue where I am completely befuddled about what the solution is going to be, because certainly politically now you do see an effort from some politicians, including a few who are running for president, to talk about free college or government assistance to repay student debts or debt forgiveness. Millennials have to be really careful with that, because a lot of these plans end up actually amounting to giving millennials' own money back. If you start looking at who are going to be the taxpayers who will be in the labor market working and producing and paying taxes at the time that a lot of those bills come due. So I'm not sure myself what the solution to this is going to be, but I do think that millennials need to be wary of boomers who come bearing gifts on this.
Stan in Ashland writes that we're on the wrong topic. He says the problem is the 1% versus the 99%, not between generations. It's the power of the 1%, which has outsourced jobs to China, determined which technologies to pursue, etc. Generational indeed. As Warren Buffett said, of course there's class warfare. My class started it, and my class is winning. That again from Stan in Ashland.
Well, I think that you can have a discussion about which are the lines that one needs to look at. I mean, I would disagree with the 1% versus 99% framing of a lot of these issues. I would say that, you know, you do need to have a view that accounts for the fact that, people at different income levels are affected by a lot of these issues very differently. You have to be mindful of the fact that people from different racial or ethnic backgrounds can be affected very differently by phenomena in the economy. People with very different educational or geographic backgrounds can be affected differently. So I'm not suggesting that baby boomers versus millennials is the definitive way of understanding these problems. But I am arguing that it is something that we need to think hard about, because one of the things the economy has always had to do is balance the interests of different generations, make sure that the young people were getting new opportunities to enter in and rise over their lifetimes. And if that's breaking down, we need to understand why that is. And thinking in terms of generations can add some more depth to that kind of discussion.
So we get the issue of the passage of time, that the boomers are beginning to die off, and then millennials will get their stuff because those are their parents. Is this the way it's going to work, you think?
Well, this is certainly a theory that you hear, that this will all work out in the wash because the boomers are going to pass from the scene one day, and then we'll have a huge inheritance boom into the tens of trillions of dollars. and that will solve all of our problems. And I don't think that that's a solution at all. I think that's exactly the wrong way to think about these problems. Because first off, on a most basic level, it goes back to the point I made in response to the listener who had emailed about boomer parents helping their children through the crisis. Inheritance is great if you have someone who in your family who is wealthy enough for you to inherit from them. But we should not be looking at a solution like that that has the potential to really perpetuate inequality in the economy when we had thought that we were developing an economy that would create opportunities even for people who didn't come from wealthy backgrounds. And then on top of that, you have the issue of whether there will be anything left to inherit because the boomers are going to live much longer than any previous generation. They're going to face much higher costs for health care and associated things during their old age. So, you know, there's this real question about how much of that is actually going to be left for their children to inherit. So I think that we need a labor market and economy in general that are working right now instead of telling millennials to hold on for the future in the hope that it'll get better then.
So we only have about a minute left here, Joseph. I just want to ask about the general thrust of the way people want to move in the economy, because we had good jobs and there was lots of manufacturing in the country. You point out there are arguments about how much it's even declined here, but is moving to a service economy part of the hurt that's falling upon millennials, or is it much more complicated than that?
Well, it is and it isn't, because certainly the economy is always going to evolve. That's always been one of the great strengths of the American economy, was that it was so nimble and adaptable. What I worry about is how much of the adaptation or the evolution that we see is natural versus how much of it is policymakers, especially boomer policymakers right now, leaning on the scale and trying to guide it. So I would like to live in an economy where we do a much better job of letting entrepreneurs, individual hardworking millennials who are very hardworking and entrepreneurial, find paths that work for them without having their elders leaning on the scale, trying to guide them one direction or another that might not work out in the end.
You certainly have given us a lot to think about. Joseph Sternberg is on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal and writes the political economics column. His book is The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. Joseph, I really appreciate you visiting with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Take care.